We have been studying Galatians chapter 2 for a good while now, and this evening we're going to particularly be looking at the issues of verses 19 and the first part of 20. In terms of our review from last week, we noticed that Paul actually in verse 18 establishes why Christ is not a deacon of sin, not the one who pursues the establishment of sin as an inevitability and even as an acceptable reality. And then the reason is, in verse 18, that Christ's doctrine of salvation by grace through faith apart from works of law is the only doctrine that is not self-contradictory. We saw in our study last week that in verse 18, Paul was actually putting him in the place of the person who would be a deacon of sin, a transgressor. And he actually was putting him in Cephas's place, because Cephas had already destroyed the doctrine of acceptability on the basis of human performance. He was the one God actually chose in the book of Acts to bring the gospel to the first Gentiles. And it was there that he said in his own testimony in Acts that God showed him that he should call no man common or unclean. And yet, in Galatians, he's treating the Gentiles as though they're unclean because he won't have any fellowship with them because they haven't been circumcised and they're not keeping the law, or they're not subject, haven't submitted themselves to the law. And Peter is posturing in front of a group that claimed that they were representing James's thought from Jerusalem. So rather than Paul just blasting Peter by saying, "You've destroyed this, and now you're trying to rebuild it," and it, you know, that's counterproductive, it proves that you're in fact the transgressor. Instead of saying it that way, he puts himself in that position and says, "If I am rebuilding what I once destroyed, then I prove myself to be a transgressor." But in effect, what he's actually saying is that the doctrine of who establishes sin as an inevitability and an acceptable thing is the person whose doctrine is self-contradictory and cannot stand. Because, bottom line, our behavior is driven by what we believe. And if our beliefs are contradictory to one another, then we get all balled up because we don't know what to believe. Because the contradictions challenge our beliefs to the point that we're stymied. And then we don't believe anything and we act in unbelief, and then we just do whatever comes naturally. And that is sin. So it's not Paul's doctrine in Galatians that creates this bad behavior. It's the doctrine of the legalists who are actually insisting that everybody keeps the law. So I just want to say this as we get into our study, that the root of the theology of those who oppose Paul's gospel is the assumption that their theology provides a better basis for godly behavior than Paul's does. That's the reason Paul raised the issue in verse 17, whether Christ was a deacon of sin, a minister of sin. The issue is the outworking of doctrine in terms of whether the behavior is moral or immoral, whether it's right behavior or wrong behavior. And the legalists obviously believe that if you drop the law on people, that'll make them behave themselves. I mean, that's their doctrine. And they think that their doctrine will provide a better basis for godly behavior than Paul's doctrine does. That's why they oppose Paul's doctrine. The favorite accusation that arises from that assumption is that Paul's gospel actually makes sinful behavior both inevitable and acceptable. I mean, how many times have you shared the gospel with somebody and they've come back with, "Well, if all you got to do is believe in Jesus, then you can sin all you want. Sin becomes a non-consequential thing, and it makes people careless," and then they start into this easy believism and all this kind of stuff. But basically, their opposition to the gospel is rooted in the assumption that if you demand that people behave, and there's some bite behind the demand, I mean, there's a consequence if they don't, then you will provide a basis for godly behavior. And Paul says, absolutely, that's not true. It won't work. So, when Paul anticipated that that would be the reaction, because you've got to remember, this is 16 years into the preaching of the gospel by the apostle, and he's run into all the objections. I mean, he's dealt with everybody's, "Ah, it can't be true because." And of course, he was a Pharisee at one point, so he already knew that theology. Forward, backwards, and every other way. So there wasn't anybody coming from the legal side of the thing that could bring up anything that Paul hadn't already dealt with. The problem is that the message of the accusers, that Paul's Christ is a minister of sin, is hopelessly contradictory. Because on the one hand, the doctrine that you are acceptable on the basis of legal performance because God demands it of you, that doctrine promotes the notion that those who are required to do good can, in fact, do good. In other words, God wouldn't have given us a command if we couldn't obey it, right? And they'd say, yeah, that's right. But it's not right. The fact that God made the demands doesn't imply anything about the ability to respond to it. But their doctrine is that those who are required by demand and penalty to do good can. But then, on the other hand, they say that their doctrine is necessary because those who can do good won't do good unless they're required to do good. You have to preach the law because that's the only way you can get them to be good. But that's completely contradictory to the notion that they're able to do good just because the command's given. For this reason, the contradiction exists in the fact that the ability to do good does not even exist in those who have to be compelled to do it. Did you hear me? If you have to be compelled to do good, you're not good. Because it's the compulsion itself tells you that you want to do something else. And that wanting to do something else, it's a revelation of your own corruption. So that's the contradiction in legal doctrine. If you tell them to behave, they can behave. And you must tell them to behave or they won't behave. Well, if they can behave and won't, that's impossible. If they can behave, that means they're essentially good. And essentially good people don't have to be made to behave. So that's why it won't fly. Those who have the inner resources to do good, without rules. But those who don't have the inner resources to do good won't do good no matter how much penalty you lay on them. Have you ever heard that poem? It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishment the skull. I'm the master of my fate. I'm the captain of my soul. Have you ever heard that? You know what he's talking about? It matters not how straight the gate. That's a direct reference to Jesus' statement that the way is broad that leads to destruction, but the way that leads to life is straight. And then, it matters not how charged with punishment the scroll. That's Revelation chapter 4 and following, where the scroll of the Lamb is handed out, and as he breaks the seals and opens, the punishments just roll out of there. He says, I don't care about all the punishments. I'm going to do what I want to do because I'm the boss. And that's the expression of sinful, degenerate human attitude. You can't make me. I'm going to do what I want to do. I don't care what it costs. Well, that's the problem. If a person doesn't have the inner resources to do good, he won't, even if he's commanded to. So this evening what we're going to do is we're going to pursue Paul's perception of how he has come by his gospel to the point where he possesses the ability to do good without a legal mandate to do it. In other words, Paul's going to help us understand in our study this evening how he's motivated to do what's right without any demand to do what's right. How did he get there? Because freedom from the law, as far as Paul's concerned, is absolutely essential as the first step into the freedom to do good. In other words, in order to be free to do good, you can't be commanded to do good. You got to be free from that demandingness or you'll never be able to do good. The reason is that if you have to be told to do it, you're already being constrained by a self-interest issue, and that self-interest kills the goodness of anything you do. The biblical mandate is to love, and that means you consider what somebody else's need is without any regard to what the cost you may be. You just don't even look at yourself. You look at them. And when the command comes, do this or you'll pay this penalty, immediately your vision turns in on yourself, because now you got to worry about whether I'm going to get this penalty or not. And that self-interest corrupts everything. And we see that in the gospel. Jesus could not possibly have had a self-interest issue in going to the cross while we were yet sinners and dying for us, because he didn't have anything to gain from it. He's God. I mean, he didn't lack. So Paul's debate with Cephas involves this whole issue of where does the ability to do what is right come from, and that's what he's dealing with in verse 19 and 20 and 21. He's actually zeroing in on the fact that, bottom line, any doctrine that does not enable a person to do what is right is a false doctrine. Any doctrine that is believed and does not produce good behavior is false doctrine. So, bottom line, God's interested in the way we treat one another. And therefore, the doctrine has to enable us to treat one another properly. So, that's what we're going to be doing this evening. Where does the ability to do what is right come from? Paul says it does not come from demand performance. Command plus penalty for disobedience. Where does it come from? Well, he claims in verse 19, through the law, died to the law so that I could live. So it comes from dying to the law. In other words, it comes from being free from the law. But what does that mean? When Paul said in verse 19, through the law, died to the law so that I might live to God, that to God is a dative with the word theos or God. And the two may be correct. It might not be two. It might be with. It might be for. In other words, Paul could have been saying, through the law, I died to the law that I might live for God. Or through the law, I died to the law that I might live with God, participating with Him. The dative is ambiguous to some degree. But the thing I want you to understand about that is that doesn't matter which of the possibilities of that dative you choose, the bottom line is still always going to be doing what is right. In other words, the problem, according to verse 17, with the gospel, as far as Paul's accusers are concerned, is that the outworking of it is evil. People treat each other badly. Christ is a minister of sin because his doctrine, according to Paul, will actually encourage people to be bad to each other, be mean to each other, to be hateful and evil and all that. And Paul said, no. It's the contradictory doctrine, the doctrine that posits two contradictory things, destroys and then rebuilds what was destroyed. That's the kind of doctrine that leaves men totally incapable, because they don't have anything to believe now. And if they can't believe something true, they can't act truly out of it. So contradictory doctrine just stymies people. They just bounce. And I don't know what to think here, because I'm supposed to do this, but I'm supposed to do this. And they're at odds with one another. So that's what Paul is driving at. So what we want to do is we want to look at this statement, through the law I died to the law so that I might live to, for, with, whatever, with God. I don't think anybody would argue that you can't live to God while doing evil. You can't live for God while doing evil. You can't live with God while doing evil. So the dative is somewhat ambiguous, but the bottom line is Paul is interested in the doctrine that produces godly behavior, because he's been accused of preaching a message that leads to ungodly behavior. So doing what's right is the issue of this context. It's the issue of the deacon of sin context, the accusation that false Christ actually fosters ungodly behavior. And I've already said this, but I'll say it again. There's no point to a gospel that doesn't deliver people from sin, because there's no point to any message that leaves the person who believes it subject to the ravages of sin. If the message doesn't deliver us from sin, it's of no use. It's worthless. If there is no heaven, all that's left is hell. So if our doctrine doesn't produce right behavior, all that's left is bad behavior. And that just means that any message we believe either delivers us from sin or it's worthless. So the question really is, which doctrine, Paul's or his opponent's, actually provides the kind of right behavior that is required for people to enjoy their existence in context of other persons, God and other human beings, and perhaps even angels? That issue is really the soft underbelly of all doctrine. That soft underbelly where a thing can be attacked and destroyed is the question of whether believing this will actually produce the ability to enjoy my existence in harmony with others or not. That's the bottom line question. So Paul's claim is that the ability to live to, with, for, whatever, to live for God, to live to God, the ability to do that starts with dying to the law. But where does dying to the law start? Well, let's answer the issue this way. Paul's claim is that one of the first issues of truly godly behavior is freedom from law. Now, I realize that means we have to understand what law is, and that's a big issue, but in its simplest terms, Paul uses the term law when he means that you have been assigned a responsibility. It is up to you to fulfill it without any special provisions. And if you don't, you will be punished for your failure. That's the law. It started at Mount Sinai, where God made a covenant with his people. And he said, we're going to enter into a deal here. I'm going to commit to doing these things, and you're going to commit to doing these things. And if you don't do these things, the things that I'm committing to do in terms of response to you is going to all be negative. In other words, do this and live. Don't do it and you'll die. And I'm here to make sure because I'm the one who's making the deal with you. And that was the initial issue of law. Do it or die. Well, that's the basic issue of law. And as long as that is the issue that resides at the basis of motivation for our behavior will never be legitimate. As long as I have to do it or pay the price, I will always be doing stuff in light of the consequence that's going to come back to me. And that's so contrary to the way life really works, because as long as I'm focused on me, I can't be focused on you. And if I'm not focused on you, I can't love you. I can't do the things that you need to be done, because what you need to have done for you may include an enormous cost to me. And if my eyes are on me, you're not going to get it. I ain't going to pay it. So when the law says, do this or die, I'm already dead. Because at the very heart of law, the very heart is the threat of condemnation. There's no point to issuing a demand if there are no teeth in it. What would be the point of telling somebody that they must do something if, in fact, you're not going to do anything if they don't? This is the great tragedy of a lot of parental misbehavior in our generation. Parents tell their kids to do something, but they don't make them do it. And every parent knows, if you don't stand right on them, they're not going to do it unless there's bite to it. So there isn't any point in giving any command if you're not going to back it up with something. And so God would have never even issued the first utterance of law if he didn't intend for there to be a consequence if you didn't do it. And that's the essence of the law. Do it or die. And under that kind of threat, no fallen son of Adam will ever do any more than just seek protection in a totally self-centered reaction, and that cannot produce good. If I have to do it to protect myself, the only reason I'll do it is to protect myself. The only time you can be free is when you're willing to say, I don't care what happens to me. Then you're free. Nobody can make you do anything if they don't have any leverage. And the only leverage they can get is some kind of threat to you. And if you're not worried about threats, there's nothing they can do. That's the real freedom. It's freedom from the pressures that men apply, because the worst that a human being can do to you is torture you to death. But since you're a child of God, what does that really boil down to? Nothing. Bottom line, boils down to nothing. Because if they torture you to death, the torture part is already underwritten by God's promise that those who suffer with Him will inherit glory with Him. And if you die, you're going to be raised from the dead. So nothing that men can do to you has any lasting impact on you, so there's nothing to be afraid of. That's the whole issue of freedom. It's just whatever. I mean, even when Jesus went to Calvary to die for our sins, the issue was not, I can't pay this. I'm afraid to pay. It's just going to cost me too much. That was not his issue. And so he was free to do it. So the first part of the freedom that we have from the law has to do with, you got to be really free. And how do you get there from here? Well, what did Paul say in verse 19? I died to the law through the law. Now, what does that mean? How did Paul die to the law through the law? Well, through the law means that the law was the effective agent that's being put into play here. What did he mean by it? Well, that's not hard. Verse 20, right off the bat, I have been crucified. That's how he died. That's the explanation of how he died. I have been crucified. But who's ever crucified? Only those who are judged by the law to be worthy of crucifixion. So it was through the application of the law that Paul was crucified. And by the crucifixion, he died to the law. It sounds maybe like it's a little bit difficult, but it's really not. The way you get free from the law is to get out of the realm where it operates. And the realm where it operates is in this world. In this physical creation after the fall of Adam, pre-resurrection. When you're functioning in the pre-resurrection fallen world, that's the domain of law. And the only way you can get out of that is to get out of it. Which means you've got to get out of that realm. The only way you can get out of it is to die. Or rapture. You can be instantaneously changed and jerked out in a twinkling of an eye by the trumpet of God. Or you can die and get out. But in any case, you're going to only get dead to the law through the application of the law. In other words, you're going to die. Because by dying, you get free. Well, how does this all work? The issue is this. In order to be free from the law, you have to be subject to the law to the point that it has been fully applied to you who is seeking freedom. In other words, the only way you're going to get free from the law is to have the law absolutely, ultimately, and completely applied to you. Once the law has been applied to you and it has killed you, then you're free from it. You don't owe it anything because you're out of its realm. Let's see if we can follow how he's thinking here. To start with, we have to understand that there's no question biblically that the law cannot simply be dismissed. God cannot just say, well, I really don't care that they've all sinned. I'm just going to forget about that. He can't do that. And we know he can't do that because there would have been no point to the gospel about the Son of God coming into this world, living a perfect life, and then being subjected to the death of the cross in order to satisfy the just demand of God against sin. There would have been no point to that if God can just blow it off. Doesn't matter. Just forget it. If God could have said, let's just forget it, he would have said, let's just forget it. And then Jesus wouldn't have had to come. He wouldn't have been subjected to all that garbage that was dumped on him. He wouldn't have had to suffer any of the stuff that he had to suffer. He wouldn't have had to go on to Calvary. He wouldn't have had to put up with every physical thing that happened to him in the crucifixion, plus the separation from his own Father. He wouldn't have had to put up with any of that stuff if God could have just said, let's forget it. Because if he could have, he would have. Let's just forget it. So there's no question that the coming of Christ for redemptive purposes only exists as a real necessity if the law has to be fulfilled, if it has to be applied to the ultimate. And why would Paul argue that his death to the law consisted of him being crucified? Verse 20. If, in fact, you don't have to worry about the law, you just dismiss it. This whole business of being crucified is no small thing. But when he says, I have been crucified, he's saying, I've died. And it's only by the application of the law unto death that a person gets free from it. So, the only way, according to this text, the only way that law can be set aside is by fulfillment of it to the nth degree. You got to go to the death in order to be free. Through the law, I died to the law. And that means I'm dead. And that takes me out of the realm of the law. What can the law do to a dead person? Nothing. Dead. So we're out of the realm of the law as soon as we're dead. It's no accident that if you apply the doctrine of the law to the nth degree to anybody, that's invariably going to destroy anybody who sinned. If you apply the law to somebody who sinned, they're going to die. That's what the law says. Do this and die. Or do this or die. If you apply the law to the sinner, he's going to die. It's going to kill him. So, the only way you can really get out of the issue is to have died to the law. So what does the Bible address this issue of death in terms of successful application? Because what's left? If you're subject to the law and it's going to kill you, the real issue of the process is whether you can survive the application of the law to the nth degree. If you survive, you'll be free. So what does the Bible teach us about our survival? What happens when we're crucified? Well, we're raised. I mean, Paul teaches this in Romans 6, where our identification with Jesus is both in his death and then in his resurrection. And he says that we are raised together with him so that we can live to him. So the only way you survive the nth degree application of law is by resurrection. So if you can get to the point of resurrection, then you'll be totally free from the application of the law. You're outside of its domain. Resurrection from the dead is the mechanism of the survival. You can go to the cross and be crucified without losing everything if you're going to be raised. But if you're not going to be raised, the application of the law is going to just destroy you. That'll be the end of it. In Romans chapter 6, Paul actually says that we won't live properly apart from our identification with the resurrection. That's where the key of life is. But it takes more than just being raised to survive the application of the law. Because Jesus said in John chapter 5, verse 29, everybody's going to be resurrected. But he says some are going to be resurrected to life and others are going to be resurrected to condemnation. So resurrection by itself is not the final answer. What's raised? That's the question. What is the survival issue of resurrection? If in fact, after you're raised, you can be cast into the lake of fire forever. The question of resurrection is what is raised? And what is united together by resurrection? The doctrine of the New Testament is, if you're raised from the dead, in the same condition spiritually that you died, then the resurrection is tied then to your pre-death situation. In the New Testament, you have to be born again before you die, because if you're not, when you're raised from the dead, your body will be raised, but it will be reunited with the old reality, that no new birth reality. And what was that no new birth reality? Your union with Adam. So if you're still joined to Adam, you've been put to death, but now you've been raised, but you were put to death joined to Adam, you're raised to a body that's now indestructible, and you're joined to a new body, but you're still the same old person. So what happens to you then? Well, then you're subject to eternal condemnation or judgment, and there's no way out of that. You're cast into the judgment of final destruction, and it's ongoing and never, it's not annihilation, don't get me wrong. It's the most horrifying, tragic scenario you can even dream of, being raised with an indestructible body, but having that body joined to the old reality. That's why Jesus said, you know, the hour's coming now is when men are going to hear the voice of the Son of God, and those that hear it shall live, because there is coming a time when everybody that's in the grave is going to hear the voice and come. They're going to be resurrected, and there'll be some resurrected to life and some resurrected to death or judgment. And the issue there is, what condition were you in before you suffered the physical death that was supposed to get you out from under the law? Because resurrection is supposed to be your survival mechanism. But it'll only be your survival mechanism if before you died you have been united to somebody besides Adam. And that somebody is Jesus. So if you've been united to Jesus in a new birth reality, then you die. When you're raised, that's the only reality there will be in that resurrection body. The union between you and the God who made you. And that union cannot produce sin. John said that, 1 John. The seed of God abides in you, can't sin. So if you have a new body and you can't sin, then you're going to inherit eternity with the capacity to fully enjoy all of the relationships of eternal glory. All the people that are there, having been born again and resurrected, the angels who didn't sin, the God who redeemed you, all of that's going to be perfectly compatible with exuberant joy forever, because you have survived the application of law to yourself. Now, I know that that's creating a little bit in our minds, but it's absolutely crucial that we understand that the soul of the person facing physical death has to be united with the Spirit of Christ before that death, or the resurrection will only produce an indestructible judgment. Now, in dealing with this matter of freedom from the law, then, what we're seeing is that Paul says, to begin with, in order to live to God, you have to die to the law. But how do you die to the law? Well, he says it's through the law that you die to the law. And then he says, what does it mean through the law? Well, he says it means crucifixion. It means death. It means you've got to die. Through the law, you're put to death, and then you're free from the law. So that when you're raised, the law has nothing else to say to you. But how does this really work now? In terms of now, Paul says that his doctrine has been charged with the idea that if I really believe this, I'll just be free to sin and it'll be okay. That's what the opposers say. And Paul says, no, that's not true. But in order to get to the truth, you have to get rid of the law altogether. It's got to be gone. You cannot have the law if you're going to be free, if you're going to be able to live to God. In other words, your life with God has got to be energized and motivated by the desire to do whatever God wants you to do. It's called love. When you want to do what somebody wants you to do, then you're properly motivated. If you have to do what somebody wants you to do, you're not properly motivated.
So how does it work?
What did Paul mean when he said, I've been crucified? What does that with Christ thing do to that phrase? I've been crucified with Christ. Well, we know on the face of it that he's not talking there about a physical reality. There was no way under the sun that Paul had nails driven through his hands, through his feet, at the same time Jesus did. In other words, being crucified with Christ is not like the two that were crucified on either side of him. They were crucified with Christ in the physical reality. He was crucified between them. They were crucified with him, but they participated not at all in what Paul's talking about. But he fully participated in something that wasn't physical. His statement, I've been crucified with Christ, is past tense. It's a perfect tense term. It says, it's already happened to me. I've suffered this. In what way, Paul? How did you suffer this? Nobody drove any nails through your hands. Nobody separated you from your father. Nobody killed you. Nobody stuck a spear in your side. That stuff didn't happen to you, Paul. He said, well, it did too. It just didn't happen at the physical level. Well, then what level are you talking about? How do we get out of this law thing if you got to die to get out of it? There's any question that if I die physically, I'm out of it. If I've been united with Christ before I die physically, because when he raises me, he's going to raise me incapable of sinning, and I'm free from the law then. I don't have to be told to do what's right. I'll just automatically do what's right. I'll be just as properly motivated as God is. His love will flow through me, and I'll just do what's right just because it's the right thing to do, and that's what I want to do. And no matter what happens in eternity future, I'll never feel constrained to do what I need to do except by desire. I want to do this. And nobody feels enslaved when they're told to do something they want to do. I mean, you're not going to put the law on me by telling me to eat a pint of rocky road. I'm not going to feel constrained by threat. If you command me to do that, I'm just going to do it because I want to. So the real issue has to do with, how does this work? How does it really work? How was Paul crucified with Christ so that he's free from the law? In order to answer that, we have to buy into what I'm going to call another reality beyond the physical level. It's a reality. I mean, it's not unreal. It's not some kind of, you know, just created in your brain thing. It's real. It's just not physical. So when he said, I have been crucified with Christ, he's talking about something that really happened, but he's not talking about it at the physical level. It didn't happen at the physical level. So how do I get to this ultimate submission to the law so that, like Jesus, I have been crucified? How do I get there? Well, that's a study in and of itself in the rest of verse 20 and 21, which we'll get into, Lord willing, next time. But let me just preface that with a couple of observations so that you'll have something to think about this week. There's a non-physical reality that's just as real as it can be because it puts us within the possibility. In fact, it puts us in the realm of godliness. We can do what's right because we want to. We can walk in love because that's what we want to do. We can do what's right without any necessity upon us except the necessity of doing what you want to do. Okay? There is a reality. It's so real that it'll empower a person to be able to operate that way before he dies physically. But the only way he can get there is if he gets out of this physical realm mentality like Nicodemus had. When Jesus said you have to be born again, he meant that. He meant, absolutely, you've got to be born again. But when Nicodemus applied that to the physical realm and said, well, can I go back into my mother's womb and come out again? I can almost see Jesus pulling his hair out. You're a master of Israel and you don't get it? Obviously, you can't crawl back in your mom's womb and come back out again. I mean, you know, Jesus is far more gentle than I am. But I can just hear the exasperation in the notion that we can tie this to the physical realm, and if it won't work in the physical realm, we can just say, well, it won't work. There's a realm beyond the physical where it does work. How do we get there? Well, we'll work into that next time, but I do want to make these observations just so that you'll have something to think about. In our Adamic reality, we're born in this world as the offspring of Adam. We are in bondage to the reality of Adam's character because Adam is in us genealogically and genetically. We are linked to Adam in a very real way, so that what was true of him is true of us. His sin is our sin. His sinfulness is our sinfulness. The depravity he brought is our depravity. We're in bondage to sin. And in order to get there, what do we have to do? Nothing. Our parents have to do something in order for us to be conceived and born, but we don't have to do anything. We come into this world in Adam, under bondage, as sinners, and everything we do from that point on is just automatic sinfulness. It may not look so bad in many cases, but it doesn't matter what it looks like. What it matters is what it is. And as far as the Bible, as long as you're connected to Adam, you're doing sin. And you don't even have to worry about it. You don't have to think about it. You don't have to work at it. You don't have to really determine that you're going to do this evil thing. You just have to be born. You don't have to believe anything in particular. Yeah, do anything in particular. You just have to have a couple of parents who produced you, and you're here, and you're enslaved to sin, and you just do it automatically without any effort. Is that how it is with a new birth? I wish it was. In some respects, it's exactly how it is. Because John said in 1 John, if you have this reality of having the seed of God in, you can't sin. So if you could function by that new reality all the time, you would just do what's right automatically, just like breathing. But the problem, obviously, is that before the resurrection of the body, before we really get out of the realm of the law in a physical sense, the process of being free from law is not as automatic as the process of being enslaved to sin. In other words, in order to be free, we have to understand and believe the things that will make us free. And in order to understand and believe the things that make us free, we have to be plugged into what God says. We have to understand what He says. We have to believe what He says. And then we'll be free, as He says. And you can't just do that automatically. I mean, if you don't turn the radio on to the radio preacher that's preaching the truth and listen to him, you'll never come to grips with it. If you don't open your Bible and read it, you'll never come to grips with it. If you don't make an effort to go to a place where the study of the Scriptures is done so that you can understand what the Bible says, so that you can understand what God says and what He meant, you'll never get free. I mean, it's not automatic like it was with Adam. All you got to do is be born and you're a sinner. You can just do whatever kind of sins. But it's not quite that way when it comes to doing what's right, doing righteously. So we really do want to pursue that. The difference is identified very clearly for us in verses 20 and 21. But we're out of time, so it's convenient that we can stop right here in terms of leaving you with something to ponder all week. The issue is, how do I get to be crucified with Christ so that I'm really free? Really free. I don't mean the Bible says I'm free, so I'm free. I mean I'm free. I can do what's right because it's right, because I want to. I'm free. Free from the law, through the law. How do I get there? That's what I want to chase around. You can study verse 20 and 21. That's where the answer fundamentally is, the essence of it. But other than that question, do you have any other questions? I'm not going to answer that question.